Hello, and welcome to Arts in Focus, a new monthly arts magazine for Central Texas on 103.3 KWBU-FM Waco NPR. I'm Jacqueline Davenport. Today's show is about Doris Miller, an African-American World War II hero, an honoree of Waco's new public art development project along the Brazos River.
Well, what came through to me about Doris Miller is the suffering that a lot of those guys had to endure. For example, they joined the Navy to see the world. Many of them became just stevedores or cooks. That's the best they could do in the Navy at that time.
That was sculptor Eddie Dixon. He and architect Stan Carroll were the team whose design was the final selection for the Doris Miller Memorial installation. In the next half hour, we'll hear about the life of Doris Miller and talk to the artists commissioned for the memorial. But first, Voice of the Arts brings us the latest arts events in Central Texas.
This is Voice of the Arts on 103.3 KWBU-FM Waco. Voice of the Arts is a weekly calendar of arts events in Central Texas.
Voice of the Arts is sponsored by the Martin Museum of Art at Baylor University. Dedicated to bringing outstanding art and cultural opportunities to campus and to our community. Online at baylor.edu/martinmuseum.
The Marriage of Figaro will be presented by Baylor Opera January 27th through the 30th, with shows running Friday and Saturday at 7:30 and Sunday afternoon at 3. Ticket information available through the Theater Department box office. The Waco Symphony Orchestra's Sunday Sounds series picks back up Sunday, January 30th at 3:30. This month's concert features woodwinds. The event is held in Woodway's Trinity at Badger Ranch. The Symphony box office has more information. Baylor Theater's next production is The Skin of Our Teeth, coming in February. Shows will run the 1st through the 5th at Baylor's Hooper Schaefer Fine Arts Center. The St. Olaf Choir is coming to Waco Thursday, February 3rd. The choir is conducted by Anton Anderson and features organist John Ferguson. The concert takes place February 3rd at 7:30 at Baylor's Jones Concert Hall. On Golden Pond, the next presentation from the Waco Civic Theater opens in February. Shows run weekends February 11th through the 20th. Ticket information can be found at the Waco Civic Theater. McLennan Theater will present the play, The 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, with shows February 18th and 19th, and again on the 25th and 26th at the Ball Performing Arts Center. Contact MCC for more information. Voice of the Arts airs six times daily on 103.3 FM. You can also access this segment on our website at kwbu.org. We encourage you to support these local arts activities in the community.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Arts in Focus, a new monthly arts magazine on 103.3 FM, Waco NPR. Doris Miller is an American hero from humble beginnings who grew up on a sharecropper farm just outside of Waco. Today in Waco, a cemetery and YMCA branch bear his name. KWBU's Derek Smith takes us through the African American's history and helps us relive his heroic acts.
December 7th, 1941, was a day that changed the lives of millions worldwide. The bombing at Pearl Harbor instigated American involvement in World War II, and many men and women began preparing to serve their country overseas and abroad. But one Waco native, like his shipmates in Hawaii, did not have time to prepare. He only had time to act. And in doing so, Doris Miller went from being an anonymous naval cook to one of the heroes of World War II. Known as Dory to his friends and family, Miller was born and raised in Waco. His childhood, like many in the 1920s, was marked by work, not just in school, but around the house and on the family farm with his brothers. He showed an early inclination to help around the house, often cooking and doing laundry at a very young age. His studies continued at Waco's A.J. Moore High School, where he participated in that great Texas tradition of high school football. His size made him well-suited to become the star fullback that he was. Despite standing just 5'9", he weighed a solid 200 pounds, a frame he used to wear down A.J. Moore's opponents. His temper earned him the nickname the Raging Duck, as he was known for getting in fights, particularly when issues of his African-American race were invoked. But the occasional fight didn't deter from the fact that Miller was a good student and a hard worker. After high school, he continued for a time on the family farm. But the aggression of dictators in foreign lands stirred Miller to enlist long before the United States officially entered the war. In 1939, still in his teens, Dory enlisted in the Navy as a mess attendant. After training, he served as the main cook on multiple ships, and in 1940, he served temporary duty in 2nd Battery Gunnery School. Then, it was back to cooking, serving the sailors on the USS West Virginia. It was this assignment that placed the farm boy from Waco in the crosshairs of history. On the morning of the Japanese attack, the USS West Virginia sat in the waters of Pearl Harbor. Aboard, Dory was preparing the day's laundry when the alarm sounded. He ran to the gun station for which he was trained, only to find it the victim of a torpedo. So he followed his orders, transported his wounded shipmates to safer quarters, a task for which the strong, raging Duck was well equipped. In the ensuing chaos, as the Japanese barrage began to take a greater toll on the USS West Virginia, Miller was assigned to help reload Browning anti-aircraft guns. Despite having no training on this machinery, Dory seized the initiative and began firing until the ammunition was out, serving his fellow soldiers as best he could as the ship began to sink. Eventually, upon orders, Miller and other survivors abandoned the ship, a victim of the Pearl Harbor attack. In the following months, Doris Miller was commended by the Secretary of the Navy and went on to receive the Navy Cross for extraordinary courage in battle. In the next 2 years, his story was shared with the nation as he became one of the legends of the war. He gave formal addresses to graduating African-American sailors and spoke in various cities, including his hometown of Waco. In May of 1943, he returned to duty on the USS Liscombe Bay. On the morning of November 24th, a torpedo from a Japanese submarine sunk the ship. Doris Miller was not among the 242 survivors, and the 24-year-old war hero rests forever in the waters of the Pacific Ocean. Though his life was brief, his legacy has outlasted him multiple times over. His likeness appeared on a nationwide campaign of naval posters, commending him for going above and beyond the call of duty, inspiring countless men and women to do the same. Buildings here in Waco and throughout the country bear his name, ensuring that new generations will learn of his courage. He was even immortalized on film, portrayed by Cuba Gooding Jr. in the movie Pearl Harbor. Tales of war in America, while marked by tragedy, often inspire with the courage of ordinary men and women who sacrifice for their country. Doris Miller displayed ultimate courage and gave the ultimate sacrifice, and that is why this Waco native is remembered now, more than 7 decades after his death.
You're listening to Arts in Focus on 103.3 FM, Waco NPR. I'm Jacqueline Davenport. In a moment, we'll hear from Stan Carroll and Eddie Dixon, the artists whose work was the final selection for the $1 million Doris Miller Memorial. Planning for the Doris Miller Memorial began in the fall of 2009, and the project was pitched to the community and later approved by Waco City Council in October that same year. The Waco City Council also made the Bledsoe Miller Park, a 2-acre site partly named for the Navy veteran, available for use for the project. The Cultural Arts of Waco, the nonprofit organization heading up the project, sent out a request for proposals across the nation in January 2010. Almost 1 year later, on Monday, January 10th, at the Bledsoe Miller Recreation Center, the finalist for the Doris Miller Memorial was unveiled.
We don't have a trumpet. But it still needs to be the Oscars. We know this as DM-14. And DM-14 began in the group of 29. It was actually 29 finalists and gradually went through to the next 16 and then to the final 5. And DM, the finalists of the Doris Miller Memorial are Stan Carroll, Oklahoma City, and sculptor Eddie Dixon of Lubbock, Texas. They are the team, and I would like them to come forwards, please, and unveil.
Doreen Ravenscroft is president and director of the Waco Cultural Arts Fest, doing business as Cultural Arts of Waco. A committee of 28 jurors, Waco citizens, consisting of community leaders, city planners, university and college professors, and businessmen and women, narrowed the submissions down to the proposal of Stan Carroll, Beyond Metal, and Eddie Dixon, sculptor. An Oklahoma native, Carroll's diverse portfolio is highlighted by the fabrication projects such as the daring steel chair at the Oklahoma Heritage Center and the iconic One Grand Flame Pavilion for Chesapeake Energy. His furniture, conference tables, and sculptures are located within businesses and homes across Oklahoma, Texas, and New York. Recently, a collaborative design, of which Carroll is a lead designer, was selected for the 195-foot-tall, $12 million Skydance pedestrian bridge, located over I-40 in Oklahoma City. Carroll has won several awards from the American Institute of Architects. He is a registered architect and registered interior designer and holds a Bachelor of Architecture from the University of Oklahoma and a Bachelor of Science in Architectural Studies from Oklahoma State University. On his recent trip to Waco Monday, Carroll was unaware his and Dixon's design was selected as the finalist for the Doris Miller Memorial. So how do you think your jury defense went this afternoon?
Oh, this afternoon. Well, I was brought under a little bit of false pretenses, but I'm so happy that of what the real agenda was. But I really truly thought I was going to be, you know, put before the jury again to answer additional questions. So I was so happy that Doreen kept it as a surprise for me. That was fun. So.
So if you can, tell me a little bit about the site and some of the things that you see as, what would you be considered, a landscape architect?
I'm an architect and a sculptor, both. Really, I mean, the site really is the first thing you look at. The bridge clearly has an enormous presence on the site, as well as the beautiful lawn, not to mention the river. I mean, there were so many things that were so gorgeous that it was hard to figure out what to focus on, so you kind of almost had to blend them all together into one place. And so it occurred to us that the most accessible, because part of the requirements were to stay off, you know, not actually physically touch the river. So that kind of defaulted to the bridge being one of the major connection points, and then just visual connections to the river itself. So the bridge is, you know, three-dimensional qualities. Its ability to define the other edge of the space was a big part of the reason that we latched onto it for the kind of to create one edge of the specific site.
Can you describe to me how your public artwork will fit in this area?
Okay. The piece has a suggestion of a ship form that offers visual presence as well as the physical experience of the place that we're trying to make. A big part of what we're doing isn't as much about the pieces that we create, but it's much about the place that we create. And so as long as we stay focused on the place, the rest of the pieces kind of take care of themselves in some, you know, that's one perspective. And then, so the piece that I started to develop was using that bridge and the river to define two edges, and then our piece actually creates that third edge to make somewhat of a triangular space. It's not a very rigid triangle, but it's kind of a three-sided space with the river, the bridge, and the ship form that the piece is comprised of. So it was really how to define that space, you know. So
where will the piece go? I mean, is it? Can you show me maybe pace out where?
Sure.
You envision everything.
The pond is going to be right over here, kind of just immediately up from the trees. The two large trees were another major factor. They're really grand old trees. You can tell they've had some years behind them, and they're just full of soul. And those trees really, you know, didn't physically ask, but conceptually they wanted to be part of the composition. And so, because they were so beautiful. So the pond is really related directly to the trees. And it's a 67 foot diameter pond, which is just right in here.
So that's a pretty big pond.
It is a fairly large pond. It's only going to be, you know, 3 or 4 inches deep. So it's that's really a necessity because of the possibility for people drowning, although we do have a river right there, which is always, I'm sure, a risk for everybody. But we didn't want to have any possibility of any kind of problems with the water, as well as we didn't really want yearns for a great deal of respect. And so if you deepen the water again, it starts to offer more of a play pond, which we were looking for a little bit more respectful position. Not that somebody couldn't, you know, dip their toes in it or something, but a shallow pond gives the visual effect, yet without some of the other added nuances. So the sidewalk will connect to this sidewalk over here along the river, and then it arches around and it connects to those steps, the existing steps that are coming down the bank near the end of the Washington Avenue Bridge. And so there's this connection point, and so you start to see the triangle of the sidewalks and then the walk along the back side, as well as if you go through the piece, you'd also kind of experience that same triangle. And then the idea is that there's the subsistence garden. Conceptually, Dory's early years were lived on a subsistence farm of his family's, and I can't imagine a more difficult way to survive. You know, how do you have time to do anything else? But he was able to figure it out and move forward. But the idea is that there's a conceptual garden that really becomes this pristine grass lawn that's on a raised platform. It's really what amounts to a raised planter bed, effectively. That's what it actually is. But it has a lot more symbolic relationship to the ship form, as well as it offers a platform for possible public speaking. Somebody, perhaps on Martin Luther King Day or any other type of a public event, where gives somebody really, it's a little quasi stage that really isn't, it's not always a stage. It really becomes a bench at other times of the year when there's not an event happening. But then the way it's related to the bridge and the edge is the bridge becomes really a balcony to this, what feels like a venue for possibly public speaking.
I guess there's two walls in this sculpture. Can you describe to me the walls and what they mean?
Basic concept of the whole piece is about, I started thinking about a ship and life on a ship at sea, and it occurs to me that it takes thousands of people to create a ship. And so the concept kind of came to mind that it takes many to make a ship. And so what we wanted to do is represent this form in a modular sense, that the ship form is really made up of these rectilinear metal panels that really represent the individuals that make up this larger ship. And so the Dory Miller story is really based upon being one of those many people that make a ship, then having Dory, as well as others who would rise at the occasion to go well up above and beyond the call of duty to actually perform as he did back in the Pearl Harbor attack. So it's really this conversation between all the people that it takes to make a ship, and then recognizing the few that rise to the occasion and really perform to the level that, you know, we're proud to be an American for. So
great. And these walls, how high are they?
The main wall is it's 16 feet tall, but it's about 140 feet long. It tapers from about 30 inches at one end, actually a little higher than that, about 40 inches at one end to about 16 feet at the other end. And then there's a second wall that's not nearly as long, but it's envisioned to be a more solid wall. That first wall is is the multiple panel concept. The many sailors make a ship. And then the front wall is more of a, intended to contrast and develop kind of an juxtaposition between all those many people that make the ship and some of the beautiful lines that a ship expresses. And so that wall is somewhat shorter, about 12 feet, and that's actually the backdrop to Dory's figure. That's a beautiful bronze figure that Eddie Dixon is going to be sculpting that for the project. And really happy to have Eddie, because I'm so thankful that you introduced us. He's a great guy. He's a fabulous guy. And great fun.
It seems like you both have a great sense of humor and that, that there's that chemistry there.
Well, it's surprising, yeah. I don't know if it's just kindred spirits or what, but we kind of come from different worlds, because he's in the figurative and I'm in the abstract world. And so when those two guys, we're not competing, because we don't, you know, it's really, we're not competitors, because we really are doing two different things. However, we bring us together and, you know, we have, you know, very bold contributions from both avenues.
That was an interview with Stan Carroll, the architect for the final Doris Miller Memorial Project selection. You're listening to Arts in Focus, a monthly arts magazine on 103.3 FM, Waco NPR. I'm Jacqueline Davenport. Carroll's partner in the project is sculptor Eddie Dixon. Dixon came into the art scene a little late, he says, but he has seen much success as a sculptor with a niche in war heroes. In less than two decades, Dixon has had over 20 major commissions. Dixon's art can be found in national historical sites, the Pentagon, West Point, Smithsonian museums, and in national parks throughout the United States. His works are also in the private collections of Colin Powell, Morgan Freeman, Danny Glover, and the late Alex Haley, Bill Lecky, and others. It was an unlikely pair, Carroll and Dixon. However, Carroll says the match couldn't be better. While Carroll's architecture and designs represents the abstract with hard-defined lines and esoteric forms, Dixon's work takes on a representational quality. He says perfection is his goal.
You heard of each other's work before?
No, I guess not.
We haven't.
If we had met, we had.
Well, I don't know. I mean, in the artist community, well, I didn't know if you all had come across each other.
We're kind of in a little bit different field. It's such a nice match, is because the figurative versus abstract, and they're two. We chase different projects,
right.
And you know, I know a lot of the abstracts, and he knows a lot of the figurative, but. You know,
they
don't cross over too much.
I wanted to speak to you about your sculpture. I mean, it's so lifelike. How do you bring these people to life, these heroes to life?
Well, I kind of specialize in unsung heroes. An idea, I guess you say I endeavor to create something perfect. Haven't been able to find it yet, but I'm looking. And I think it's justice for these individuals that sacrifice so much for us. To put a caricature or something of this nature up is an insult. So I try to bring as much life to them as I possibly can. I have a passion for it. I empathize to the degree that I can feel these people. So this is why.
And what came through to you about Doris Miller?
Well, it came through to me about Doris Miller is the suffering that a lot of those guys had to endure. For example, they joined the Navy to see the world. Many of them became just stevedores or cooks. That's the best they could do in the Navy at that time. And instead of accepting the adversities as an enemy or something to hold him down, he endured enough that he could, when the call of freedom came, he was able to come out and do above and beyond. He was able to stand the post. The Navy was a hard road to hoe, but he endured. And when it came for him, when the time came for him to perform, he performed. Even when he didn't have to. he sacrificed. And that's kind of what war is about. You're not fighting for color or race or anything of this nature. You're fighting for your buddies. You're fighting for your friends. You're fighting, I guess men become cattle religious. You're fighting for the herd.
And can you give me a little bit of history about your career as a sculptor?
Well, I started a little late, and kind of stumbled into it. I was making a fancy candle with a stick and a butter knife. That's how it all started. And someone asked me to have it cast, and I did. I was going to have it cast, and they asked, I didn't know anything about casting, so when I did decide to cast it, I found out where the casting place was. They told me it was going to cost a certain amount of money. I said, I think that's too much. And when I'm rich and prosperous, I'll come back. And he said, well, what are you going to do with it? I said, I'm going to burn it. Of course, it's a candle. And the guy, Jerry House at the House Bronze Foundry, said, Eddie, don't do that. He said, if you give us one copy, I'll give you three free. And I was flattered that he wanted my work. And I said, then you mean I have potentials? He said, greatest potentials. So from then on, I started sculpting. I tried it. Took a leave of absence from the Board of Trades, and then I tried to sculpt, and it worked.
So those initial four castings started your business as an artist.
Correct. It really did. And I approached a gallery in San Francisco, and they thought they wouldn't accept anything but established artist works. And they saw my pieces, and they decided they would try them out. And quite a few sold there, too. That kind of started my career off. But at that period of time, I was doing Mercenaries and Warriors of the B.C. and A.D. era. I wasn't doing anything like Unsung Heroes. I was just doing these individuals of warriors. And I thought that was a very interesting part of history, so this is what I was doing at that time. And they sold extremely well. People loved that. They could hear the ancestral voices calling. They could go back and they could relate to these different parts of their history. And so I enjoyed it. Everything from Genghis Khan to Theodoric, you know.
And you're a lover of history as well. That's
and I love history. Yeah. Out of school. Hated it in school. That same old dull stuff they tell us about the cherry trees and stuff like that. And never lie.
Well, I guess so. What did you think about getting this commission?
I was flattered that they considered me, and I love the fact that they did. It was an opportunity to do a piece again. It was an opportunity to do another Unsung Hero. And so I was flattered. I was glad when Stan called me, spoke with me about it, and yes, I was very grateful.
The Doris Miller Memorial Project is hardly finished. Over the course of the next year, Cultural Arts of Waco and community members heading up the project have the monumental task of raising $1 million for the projected budget of the commission. Thus far, over $50,000 has been raised for the memorial. The completion of the sculpture is scheduled for November 2012, and it will debut December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day, that same year. You can find images of the proposed sculpture at kwbu.org, along with photos from the finalist announcement Monday. Thanks for listening to 103.3 FM, Waco NPR. I'm Jacqueline Davenport. Join us again at 3 p.m. Sunday, the third Sunday of the month, for Arts in Focus, a monthly arts magazine for Central Texas.